In the Weimar Republic, I know that some people, they write about this on Twitter, they talk about this, they say, oh my gosh, we're going to go towards this type of hyperinflation and it's going to be a total disaster. They really see this worst case scenario happening. Do you think that that's in the cards?
I don't.
Why not? Is your full name Peter?
It is Peter, but in my writings and my articles, I go by Peter C. Earle because there is another economist named Peter Earle. So in my writings and books and stuff, it's Peter C. Earle, but when I talk to people, it's always Pete.
Okay, well, that's great. I think you seem like a Pete to me.
I agree.
Well,
that's what I'm going for.
Well, that's great, and I'm really glad to have you here on Liberty Curious. A place where all of the curious people about liberty can come and hear ideas with interesting people. So Pete Earle, you have been, you've had quite the resume. You've worked, you know, on Wall Street for 20 years. You've been in the military. You've done a whole bunch of things. You're involved in cryptocurrency and you're also senior research faculty at AIER. I know you didn't want me to do such a formal introduction, but I just want people to know who you are and who they're hearing from. And this way they can get a little bit of your perspective and understand who you are as well.
Good. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Great. You're welcome. Very glad. So we wanted to kind of look at what inflation actually is, because there are many myths around inflation. There are many scapegoats in this inflationary period as well, like Putin's price hike or those greedy corporations, the oil companies, and, you know, many, many other fingers of blame being pointed. So can we first and foremost get your perspective on what inflation is?
Sure. So today, when you hear a media pundit or even the government talk about inflation, they usually mean the increase in the general level of consumer prices. We call it the general price level. But traditionally, monetary inflation means growth in the size of the money stock, which is to say an increase in the amount of money in existence. And that leads or can lead to price inflation. That's usually the end result of monetary inflation. And that's where you see a rise in the general price level. But there's an important caveat that really needs to be brought up when we say these things, is that they don't move in sync, right? So if you get an increase in the money stock of, say, you know, 25%, it doesn't necessarily mean the prices or the general price level is going to increase by 25%. So that's an important distinction. When you hear the word inflation today, generally speaking, in the media, by pundits, you know, by the government, et cetera, they generally mean price inflation, such as you would see in the CPI and so on.
Okay. Okay. So monetary inflation, would that really have to do with how much money is being put into the economy?
Yeah, that's typically a function of the Federal Reserve or whatever central bank or in some countries currency board, you know, we're talking about.
Okay, okay. So when we're looking at kind of what we've seen over the last couple of years, there's been a lot of money printing. And so all of these kind of trends that we've been seeing in the price inflation, is that correlated to that then?
Yeah. It is. You know, there's another element which has to do with demand for money and also other aspects like that. But we'll try to keep it as not as basic as possible, but reasonably basic. And we'll say, you know, we should probably distinguish first between inflation, and here we're talking about price inflation, and changes in relative price.
Okay.
Do you want to?
Yeah, let's go into that. Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So when we talk about price inflation, you know, first of all, money is a good. It's a special good, but it's still a good like any other. And therefore, it's subject to the same forces of supply and downward sloping demand curves that any other good is. But when we see changes in price, right, there's two reasons that can happen. So let's say the price of oil changes. That can be because monetary policy is essentially eroding the value of money, which is its purchasing power, and therefore it takes more dollars to buy the same good. But we also have relative price changes, which means just changes in the price of a good because of supply and demand. For example, as less oil is, say, reaching the United States because of a war somewhere or because refineries are backed up, you're going to see the price rise. And that's not necessarily because of inflation. That's just a relative price. That's saying that the price is rising because more people are trying to buy and there's less supply, and that's pushing the price up.
Okay.
What really makes the difference is that when you have a relative price change, for example, more people, say, buying oil and pushing the price up, what you tend to have is in the rest of prices, or in certain other prices, could be prices of substitutes or whatever, a fall in the price. When you have inflation, you have, again, price inflation, you have prices rising pretty much at different rates, but pretty much all prices are rising at the same time.
Okay. So is that, what are we seeing right now, referring to those two things?
Right. So if we put this in the context of oil, you know, we had basically what we saw was we had in late 2020, early 2021, right, on the heels of both a massive expansionary monetary policy campaign and fiscal stimuli, which was the U.S. government sending out stimulus checks. Those are both policy responses to the COVID pandemic. Between January of 2020 and January of 2021, the price of a barrel of oil, we're talking about WTI, that's West Texas Intermediate, more than doubled. That's from roughly $44 to about $97 per barrel. Now, there was no war in Ukraine yet. Putin hadn't even started to put troops along the border yet. That's purely price inflation. That's many, many more dollars chasing basically the same amount of goods and services, right?
Yep.
Same thing happened in gasoline. We had the average price of a gallon of gasoline went from $2.50 to almost $3.75, I believe. So at that time also, we had price rises in consumer. I wrote articles about what was happening in semiconductor chips, in avocados and all that. Mm-hmm. Those are all clearly increases in the general price level. Now in February of 2022, we saw a jump from $92 to $123 a barrel of oil. That was with the invasion of Ukraine. Now that's a relative price move as supply diminished and demand grew for more supply. Since then, over the last 2 or 3 months, we've had the WTI price per barrel go back to between, I'm looking at Bloomberg, 100 to 110, something like that. That's pretty much a continuation of what we saw throughout last year. So anybody who wants to blame Putin has to first explain the more than doubling of the oil price throughout 2021, long before the invasion.
Mm-hmm.
They then have to explain, they also have to explain why rents, airline tickets, avocados, prices of vacations all increased over that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
There's a short pop in oil prices between, say, February and April. Those are relative price changes. But the inflation that's killing people at the pump and where this all got started for over a year has to do with monetary policy and expansion of the money stock leading to price inflation.
So it was basically how the government responded to COVID, the lockdown policies, the supply chain breakdowns and all of that kind of thing that led to those rising prices way, way before Russia and Ukraine thing even began. And now they're using this as a way to focus the attention there rather than take the blame for having maybe caused this earlier.
Sure. So I mean, you know, there's been a lot of excuses thrown around to explain the inflation. One of them I see a lot of is called market power. People have said, well, you know, it's the market power of oil companies that's creating these price increases. But that really sort of confuses two concepts, right? People saying that market power most of the people using the term market power are really confusing market share with market power. And so what they're trying to say is that the concentration of market share among a handful of oil companies gives them the power to raise prices. But there's two huge problems with that, right? First is there isn't a strong relationship between market concentration and pricing power. I could use the example of Uber and Lyft, right? So we have a market dominated by two firms,
mm-hmm.
but outside of surges, they compete neck and neck. One can't just run prices up against the other. So that sort of blows that argument out of the water. But even more fundamentally than that, and this always kind of makes me snicker, it's not like the world has gone from 50 major oil companies to 6 or 8. the oil industry has looked at this for decades. And you'd also, people saying that would have to explain why prices rose, you know, basically doubled over the last year. And then they suddenly, you know, gained another, say, 10 or 20% briefly when the invasion of Ukraine began. It's almost as silly an explanation as greed.
I
can give you my shtick on greed if you want. I can do it real quick.
Yeah,
greed is a silly explanation because it doesn't pass the basic empirical sniff tests, right? If oil companies are greedy, why are they suddenly so greedy? And why are they so much greedier than others? You know, if they could turn it on overnight, why wouldn't they turn it off now that all the scrutiny is upon them? Right. So it's ridiculous. It's an argument. It's a line of argument, frankly, that doesn't even dignify a response.
Right. These all sound like really old arguments, like the same thing over and over again, you know, like monopolies and corporate greed. And, you know, Biden just came out with this scathing letter against the oil and gas companies saying you guys need to pay your fair share and all of that. So, like, it seems like these stories are being used as a way as well to kind of push the political narratives of whoever's in power at the time.
Sure. I mean, those are readily usable arguments because most people have to drive and most people buy gas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, frankly, the state of economic education is not only is not what it should be, it's not what it used to be. And I think people need a
crash course.
Bogeyman. No, I think they need to. They want to look at a certain industry and say those are the bad guys, you know. But those arguments are not. Like I said, I wouldn't. Those arguments are not even worth discussing, other than in the context of maybe a joke.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. I mean, it's rather than taking responsibility, it's easy to point the finger of blame elsewhere because people are looking for somebody to blame. Like when they show up at the tank and they see these costs, when they go to the grocery store and they're spending this much, like they want to find somebody to blame this on, which is kind of a normal human tendency. So, you know, what then actually, if it's not greed, if it's not all of these kinds of other things, then what really causes inflation?
That's the logical place to start. So I'm going to quote Milton Friedman. I think his concise explanation is good. Inflation, he said, is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. And the primary cause of inflation, again, price inflation, is an increase in the quantity of money, so much that or such that more money is chasing the same or roughly the same amount of goods and services. I think of it, and I explain it as bidding up prices, right? If you have 10 goods and let's say $10 and you expand to $11, you now have $11 trying to squeeze into or trying to acquire 10 goods, except of course it's on a scale many orders of magnitude greater than that. And that's basically, without getting into some more technical concepts, that's really the best way to look at it. Price inflation begins with expansionary monetary policy, and that results in prices rising over time. And another way to look at it is that each dollar is worth incrementally less over time. Well, that's a fall in the purchasing power.
Well, this kind of makes sense as well. Like when 1971, you decouple from the gold standard at that point, like there was a huge inflationary surge there not long after. And now people are comparing that to what we're seeing now, but over time, like there's pretty much been inflation since then, hasn't there?
Sure. I mean, the dollar has lost something like, I mean, it's over 95% of its value since in the last 100 years, and it's got to be maybe 75% of that or more since 1971.
Wow, that's enormous.
Yeah.
Huh. Yep.
Every time your grandparents says something like, "Oh yeah, you know, a McDonald's hamburger used to be 25 cents," it's not that. I mean, certainly prices have risen, but a lot of it has to do with the fact that just $1 buys that much less.
Yeah. So you know, people as well nowadays, they're looking at this and saying, "Why can't I afford things? Why can't I afford the things that my parents could afford, like a house?" And then they look at their grandparents' generation, and you know, it's like, well, that's a totally different era. Not really looking at it in terms of those shifts in monetary policy. So could we maybe talk a little bit now about the relative price changes in the context of oil and gas and the invasion of Russia and Ukraine and all of the rest of that?
Sure. So we had inflation again from throughout 2021, and prices were rising already because of the massive, the massively expansionary Federal Reserve programs, and we were also hit on top of that by the effects, the relative price changes that resulted from Putin's invasion of Ukraine, which had a few effects. I mean, first of all, it was difficult so Russia was kicked off they were kicked out of a bunch of different payment system. Yeah,
yes, you know, I used to use yes.
So there's that transactions that means the transactions that are usually denominated in dollars weren't or couldn't be. So then Russia insisted that people use rubles, and of course the ruble was nowhere near as liquid or as widespread a reserve currency. Or people don't generally keep a lot of their FX reserves in rubles. So all of that made it more difficult to acquire oil. And then also fighting in the Black Sea prevented a lot of shipping. So all of these effects together created the relative price, the scarcity of oil, which sent the prices up from that $97 to $100 all the way up to about $120 a barrel. Now it's back down between $100 to $110, but that could change again. If there's a new development in the war, or certainly if inflation begins to rise, that's going to be a factor as well. So I think an important takeaway here is that it's very difficult to determine when prices are rising, especially in prices at times when there's inflation, what portion of that price rise is accountable to inflation and what portion can be attributable to, say, relative price changes or actual, say, supply and demand in that particular good.
Yeah, it's easy to just kind of lump it all together, right?
Yep.
I guess what the word you were looking for was swift.
I can't believe I couldn't remember the name of Swift.
I forgot it as well. It just came back to me. So there we go.
Right.
But yeah, so this is kind of really interesting as well, because, you know, I look at this as well, just as a regular person watching all of this. And, you know, I think about as well, Build Back Better and that whole agenda. And then you see, okay, you know, oil and gas prices are soaring, and then you have this whole event that happens with Russia and Ukraine, and now it's getting even worse, and now people are really feeling it at the pump. And then, you know, here's the problem, and we have the solution. It's Build Back Better, and we keep hearing about this more and more. Would you like to speak to that a little bit?
I mean, I'm more a monetary than a fiscal guy, but I mean, you know, at this point right now, there's no way you're going to hear anything approaching a realistic economic assessment of massive fiscal policy. You know, it's either going to involve printing more money or selling more bonds. And I'm pretty pleased at this point that the last legislative attempt was failed. It was put on ice for a bit, but there's no way this would help, that's for sure.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. So now could we also talk about some of the lesser known effects of inflation, things that people aren't really thinking about?
Oh, sure. So in addition to the rise in prices, there's a handful of other issues that occur when you have an inflationary updraft. There's four or five of them I'll discuss. And the first one, the most basic one, is probably surge costs, right? So as prices begin rising, some sellers of goods and some buyers, right, are going to want to know what the right price is for them to sell and buy at, right? So a seller is going to want to know what other people are selling at so he can adjust his prices and be competitive. And buyers are going to spend time going around from place to place. Those goods that don't have ready substitutes, where you have to buy a certain good, right? They're going to want to know, they're going to want to go price shopping and comparing. So both buyers and sellers are going to spend more time trying to find the goods they want at prices closer to what they paid in the last time period, or at least the best price at this time period, whether that's, you know, comparing with a week ago, a month ago, yesterday, whatever. So, you know, let's use the example of somebody who pulls into a gas station, right? And they see regular gasoline at $4.98. I think that was the most recent price, right?
Yeah.
They immediately have to decide whether this is likely going to be the case everywhere, this price, or whether it's worth leaving and driving in around to another gas station, maybe a few more. So two things are at work. First of all, in an inflationary updraft, the information content of prices is reduced because you can't tell what portion of this move is just more dollars chasing the same goods and services or whether this is actual scarcity you're seeing. Hmm. When you have a relatively stable price level, right, the price of a certain good or service moves, it's usually reflective of a supply or demand change. But when inflation hits, it gets more impossible. It also means that people are going to be more inefficient. They're going to be spending more time instead of consuming or producing, looking around. So that's search costs are very subtle, but what it all amounts to is sort of a lowering of efficiency, a lowering of productivity.
Yeah, and that's really a hidden cost in a way as well, because time is money. And, you know, some people may be paying people to even be doing this kind of thing as well, to be doing this kind of research in different companies as well, not just on an individual basis, right?
Yeah. So one of the things about all these like sort of secondary effects of inflation, including search costs and the others that I'm going to mention, are that they trickle through. They affect one person, and then that person's, you know, their productive output or their time is spent doing this instead of something else. And, you know, their employers are going to get less for their money. And that means that eventually consumers are going to get less of whatever that good of services. So these things are really pernicious, and they sort of spread insidiously throughout society. Another, if you'd like, I mean, to continue, is the impact on economic calculation, right? So frequently we're taught or we think of prices as indicative of value, right? But they're really not. Value is subjective. So prices don't really measure. But what they are is, it's good to think of prices as exchange ratios derived on markets, right? And those are established by the entirety of individuals, everybody buying and selling, right? So more people decide to buy something, the price gets pushed up a little bit, that sort of thing. So prices are always fluctuating somewhat, even without inflation, again, relative prices, and sometimes they fluctuate a lot. And that's really part of the genius of the price system, is that as prices rise, they indicate scarcity. And that directs, you know, spontaneously without any sort of command directive or anything like that, rising prices sort of signal to the world of producers, hey, there's a shortage here. And what that means is if you used to sell here and now the price is up here, that means there are profit margins, there are increased profits for bringing more goods to this particular area, whether that's lumber, whether that's other finished goods, whatever. So prices rise, they signal scarcity, they serve to direct resources towards certain uses, whereas when they fall, they indicate abundance. And people would say, well, maybe instead of, you know, bringing this good to the market, I'll bring another. Mm-hmm. And that's the way the price system works. It's an absolutely brilliant system.
Yeah.
The market's a process, right? We like to think of it as a fixed establishment. And of course, because we have supermarkets and stock exchanges, we think of markets as places. But the market is a process. And it's actuated by the interplay of the actions of various individuals that cooperate under the division of labor, right? So forces determining this continually shifting state of the market are subjective value judgments by individuals and their actions, right? So they buy things, they sell things, and at any given moment, the state of the market is at that instant, that price structure is basically the totality of the exchange ratios of goods established by people, right? Yeah. So what that means is that when entrepreneurs look at prices to determine real scarcity, they engage in a process called economic calculation. And that economic calculation, although it's called calculation, it really is sort of a qualitative assessment. They say, I'm looking into the market. Here's a good or a service that I think consumers want, but it's not available. And then this calculative process means they say, if I take good A plus good B, I can do it for a certain price and maybe I can offer it for a profit. And that's how consumer desires are met by entrepreneurs. So this ranges from everything from capital goods created by investing, whether that's machines, buildings, and all that, to the very end goods in the term structure of production, like toothpaste, things you and I would buy. That whole process of production is a product of economic calculation at different levels, right?
Yeah.
So there's a reason why we use concrete and not copper to build bridges, right? Because we have figured out with prices where the best uses of our time and of those resources are. It's rational economic allocation. Mm-hmm. And so when monetary expansion causes price inflation, we'll just call it inflation, the information content of prices is reduced. So, you know, you can think of it, if you're familiar with the concept, as a higher noise to signal ratio. Mm-hmm. And it's much more difficult for entrepreneurs to figure out what the best use of resources is.
Right.
And in turn, we'll talk about this with the next thing I'm going to mention. And in turn, it's very difficult to determine whether a given project is going to be profitable or not. Right.
Yeah.
All startups are speculative.
Yeah.
Right? But with the monetary unit fluctuating beyond, you know, the expected day-to-day shifts, resources are more likely to be misallocated. And what happens is with less effective uses of resources, we have less productivity altogether. And productivity is where growth and prosperity comes from. So this is what, by the way, I think an important thing to mention here is that this was the inability to calculate economically. It was basically Ludwig von Mises' one-stop defenestration of the possibility of socialism. Without prices, rational allocation is impossible. Now, we're not talking about no prices, but we're talking about prices which are increasingly distorted by monetary policy. So that's the inability to calculate economically or less efficient economic calculation is another result of expansionary monetary policy and price inflation.
Yeah, that is so brilliantly said. Can you maybe give a historical example of what can happen there then? Putting you on the spot.
Well, sure. an example of it would be, now this, I don't want to get into the whole business cycle discussion because there could be and there are volumes of books written about that. But what I would say is that when we have bouts of inflation, what happens is you tend to see a lot of businesses being started, which again, I really don't want to get into, this is a very complicated subject, but let's just say that the bust you see at the end of a business cycle, what we call a recession, a lot of times the liquidation process of businesses that suddenly prove either unprofitable or that there's less consumer demand than we're expected. That's oftentimes a product of distorted economic calculation. Another thing is so right now I'm talking about economic calculation, which again, I think it's best thought of as qualitative, but next I'll talk about financial accounting, which is quantitative. But mm-hmm. in both cases, I think it's important to think about the extreme case, right? So I think that people saying hyperinflation around the corner are, I think it's amateur hour. It's a silly thing to say. A mere, 8% inflation like we're seeing right now is bad enough. But if we think about the extreme case, if we think about prices moving so rapidly that people are throwing their money into buy goods before the money can lose value. I mean, just imagine trying to figure out what kind of a business would be profitable in those situations, right?
Yeah.
If I want to buy trees and use a lathe and make baseball bats or something like that. I mean, if the prices are whipping around and if consumers are having to go through all these things like searching where to put their money and then trying to assess what they can buy. I mean, It's just a non-starter. So, we're looking at these things in a more immediate sense, in our 6, 7, 8, 10% inflation. But you don't have to have extremes for this to be a really sort of an upending of the of economic allocation, of the efficiency of the economic system.
Yeah, yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I'm thinking here as well about. I know you want to talk about, the accounting aspect, but I also think there something that maybe you'll want to speak to later, which are the social effects of this kind of inflation. So whatever sure. you'd like to get to first, but I think that paints a picture in my mind for sure.
Sure, sure. So basically when it comes to accounting, this gets a little bit wonky, but every firm, whether it's publicly traded or private, has to decide whether to introduce new products, whether to attempt to enter new lines of business, to buy other firms, to pitch investors, all that sort of thing. Accounting is the life's blood. That's internal calculation. And if you're on the outside, if you want to assess the performance of a company, if you want to coordinate with a company wants to coordinate with, say, regulators, all that sort of thing, it's absolutely critical to have sound and timely accounting. And when inflation gets running, accounting gets affected. You know, one of the most fundamental assumptions of accounting, of sound accounting practices, is the stable monetary unit. Again, I don't want to, I could go into a long list of accounting effects, which would be boring and they wouldn't really make my case. But I mean, if you think it between, if we think of this, and this also goes with the economic calculation example I used before, between 1922 and 1923, again, an extreme example, In Germany, the ratio of marks to dollars went from 800 marks to a dollar to 250 million marks per dollar, right? That's in 12 months. Now, just to try and imagine using those marks over a period of time, how to figure out what's profitable, what's not, that sort of thing. I mean, and again, we don't need hyperinflation for that to materialize. We're probably beginning to see the very effects of inflation on accounting in the U.S. as a lot of American companies are restating earnings or claiming that they're going to have trouble determining whether certain business lines should be continued and all that sort of thing. So it doesn't take much inflation for these things to be a problem.
Yeah, I could see how that could be a problem. Like, how are you supposed to even be able to count if you don't have some kind of standard and something that stays stable enough? Right?
Right, right. And it's key what you said, stable enough. So, you know, sound money doesn't mean a fixed and unmoving price system. It means one that's not, you know, overtly influenced or inordinately influenced by, preferably not at all, by political influences, and instead responds to the buying and selling of both money as a good and the goods we exchange for money.
So basically what we're seeing now overall, if we step out a little bit, is that the inflation that we're experiencing is a gross distortion that makes it really difficult for people at all levels to make decisions.
Yep, absolutely right. It makes economic calculation and rational allocation of goods more difficult.
Yeah. And so the, sorry, go ahead.
You wanted me to get to social effects, or
I was actually thinking about that there. So, you know, social effects. So one of the things that I was thinking about is, you know, if you don't know how much something is going to cost in 6 months from now or in 6 weeks from now, whatever it is, like, I could just see those scenarios of people heading to the grocery store, panicking, heading to the gas stations and panicking, you know, filling up jerry cans and all of that kind of thing. And, you know, those kind of tensions that arise between people when you kind of shove them all into that state of mind in the same place, all competing for scarce items. So, yeah, that's what I was thinking. So maybe you want to speak to the social unrest at different levels.
Yeah. So what you just mentioned, almost all the social changes that are documented in either minor inflations or severe ones, like, say, Weimar Germany, Venezuela, Zimbabwe, they all fall under this broader category of what we call changes in time preference. Excuse me. Time preference is essentially, it's basically a characterization of an individual's relative valuation for present consumption versus future, right? So if I say, you know, if I describe someone as having a high time preference, that means they would rather consume today versus tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And you can compare people in terms of their time preference. And so what happens is, when you have prices rising, or if you want to look at it the other way, it's the same thing, when you have the value of the unit of currency decreasing over time, it reduces the incentive to save and it encourages consumption. With less saving over time, we get less investment, less innovation, and all that. But I mean, what you were describing before is, again, you know, some of these things are easy to see in extreme cases. I'm not claiming that we are going to see a hyperinflation here at all. Mm-hmm. But in hyperinflations, what you see are people, the minute they get money, they rush to a store and they buy something. They buy anything so they can lock in value. Now, if they have a chance, they like to assess what's, you know, readily tradable in a few weeks from now. But the last thing they want to do is hold on to money, because money is losing value. There's actually a story from Ernest Hemingway about when he was in Paris after World War II during the During the hyperinflation, I'm sorry, not in Paris. He was working in Paris, but he was in Germany for a weekend, one of the many weekends he spent there. But he ordered a cup of coffee or tea, and basically the server told him, "Are you planning on having more than one cup of coffee?" And he said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, we'll order them both right now because the price will be higher when you get to the second cup." I mean, that's an extreme example.
Wow.
But that really sort of shows sort of the distortion in planning and the inability to plan that comes with very high rates of inflation, people stockpiling and trying to lock in purchasing power before they lose it. And that really finds its way into all sorts of human undertakings under extreme conditions.
So, in the Weimar Republic, I know that some people, they write about this on Twitter, they talk about this, they say, oh my gosh, we're going to go towards this type of hyperinflation and it's going to be a total disaster. They really see this worst case scenario happening. Do you think that that's in the cards?
I don't.
Why not?
I don't think that's in the cards. I think that the type of inflation that would take would require... there are conditions which sort of led to those things happening. It's very rare. There have been huge inflationary campaigns in other places where that didn't happen, where they didn't have hyperinflations. And I would also say it's sort of a distraction from what matters, and that is that, you know, even low levels of inflation, even the 2% that was said to be the Fed target for a long time, has a distortive effect. And what I usually say when people say, you know, why don't you think, or what makes you, sort of dismiss the idea that there could be a hyperinflation here? I wouldn't say it's impossible. I think it's very unlikely. But ask any friend of yours who's lived in, say, Argentina or Brazil or even Russia, a few places. Ask them if a very sort of boring and vastly less than hyperinflation, like a rate of, say, 20% a year inflation, isn't enough to destroy, you know, your business or your life. I mean, we don't have to have a hyperinflation to basically destroy the economic underpinnings of an exchange system.
Yeah, especially now. Especially now that people are basically living paycheck to paycheck. They have a lot of debt. They don't have that much savings. You know, in general, that's kind of where we find ourselves. So,
sure.
Okay, so now we've spoken about all of this and we've spoken about basically who is being blamed by government, which is, you know, as Milton Friedman would say as well, it's not, you know, foreign sheiks, it's not corporate greed, it's not anything else except for government and because they own the printing press. So like if I would have to ask you, if I would ask you, who would you assign blame to for this inflationary problem? Who would you choose?
First and foremost, of course, the Federal Reserve. I mean, I would blame the Fed. They are the ones with their fingers on the lever, so to speak. I hate to use mechanical examples because that's part of the problem is that we can't push buttons and turn levers and change the economy. The economy is not mechanistic. It's organic. I mean, first and foremost, it's got to be the Federal Reserve. Second of all, though the Fed is said to be and supposed to be independent, there are tons of political pressures on the Fed. The previous president put pressure on them. The current president has. Every president, basically, going back really to the start of the Fed, have put certain degrees of pressure on the Fed. So there's political pressures as well. And, to some extent, you know, whatever the combination of factors are that have led to a condition where our great-great grandparents knew more about economics than we do. Farmers with the equivalent of an eighth grade education in the late 19th century understood far more than people today, even people with advanced degrees, you know, the basics of inflation and supply and demand and all that. I would say the awful state of economic education, whether mm-hmm. that's formal or informal, is the third one. But I don't want to let the Fed off the hook. The Fed is the responsible institution. It's the Fed's fault.
Well, that makes sense as well, because I mean, in academia, we see that, you know, the ideas that have become popular over time tend to be on a certain you know, going in a certain direction. And people don't really learn about that in their regular, you know, post-secondary or even secondary school. You don't really learn about economics in a way that's varied. You don't really learn about Austrian economics. I actually just did a chat with somebody who had studied economics in school in Canada and who said, you know, I never learned about Austrian economics and I was studying for a business degree, right? So there's something to be said about the trends in academia as well. And I guess it's keeping people in the dark and they're no longer really connected with how, you know, markets are a process, as you said, and we are part of that process. They affect our lives and people are maybe just naive about that, ignorant and hopefully not disinterested. This is kind of why we'd like to talk about these things on Liberty Curious. This is kind of the point of the show.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, money is an absolutely astounding social technology. I think it's so profound. I think it's sometimes difficult to get our minds around. I mean, money makes the division of labor possible. It permits voluntary and peaceful exchange. I can transact with a stranger because of money, because money exists, and it gives us a tool for economic calculation. So, you know, when we have inflation, money, again, a subtle but profound innovation, is distorted, and there are predictably deleterious effects on human welfare. And again, you know, we talk about sound money, and sound money is critical, but sound money doesn't mean a fixed price level. It does mean the money is anchored in such a way that opportunities for political interference are minimized. Monetary policy and the effect on all of us, whether that's social effects and, you know, everything else, is a topic that's easily understated. Maybe that's why I'm an economist.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, I can see that you're passionate about this. You're also into cryptocurrency. You have a company that deals with that as well. And I just kind of like to just thought of this, like, you know, looking at Bitcoin and what's happening there, we see that it's kind of around, I think it's 27 or something at this point. A lot of people, I think, were mistaking it as being an asset that would be a good inflationary asset. Like, would you like to say a little bit about Bitcoin and what you see going on there?
So I think we know pretty decisively now that Bitcoin is not a great inflation hedge. but there's a number of reasons for that. One reason I think is that we've had the involvement, or we've had a lot of large investment banks and hedge funds get into Bitcoin. And I'm not blaming them for this, but I am saying that they've introduced, I think, a lot of cyclicality in that Bitcoin is a risk asset. And when markets start falling and they need liquidity, whether for margin calls or to buy things opportunistically, Bitcoin and crypto more broadly, not being proven, is one of the first things they dump, and I think they can get in a lower price. So I think that what I'm saying is I think that the institutional involvement has a lot to do with the price volatility that we're seeing in Bitcoin and other cryptos, and it's still an unproven asset. I mean, you know, something may come along in the next year or 10 years that could be a category killer and could make all the cryptos that are out right now immediately obsolete. So that's the nature of technology anyway. But I think it's a very speculative asset. And also I think that the involvement of investment banks and other firms, other professional firms in Bitcoin has made it act more like, say, an equity would than a currency or something like that.
Thank you so much, Pete. This was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me. It was a good time. Let's do it again sometime.
And if you want to learn more and read more from Pete Earle, you can visit AIER.org.